From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, you're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Across the country, people are fascinated by true crime stories. They're drawn to the mystery, the investigation, and the real-life drama of victims and perpetrators of crime. Audiences are invested in every little detail, and so are the forensic artists that are helping to solve these crimes. Through sketch composites, crime scene renderings, and even skull reconstructions, attention to detail is important in their field of work. So joining us today to talk more about why this work is so important and how she does it is forensic artist Carrie Stewart Parks. Carrie, really nice to have you on the program.
I am so thrilled to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
So I wanted to start our conversation out by asking about the sketches that so many of us are used to seeing on TV or online of missing people, maybe even wanted fugitives. How does that process work?
It's fascinating. We start off by just asking the first a very simple question: would you know the guy again if you saw him? If the answer is yes, then it's up to us, the artists, to get that information from their memory. If they say, nope, I wouldn't know him again if I saw him, it's, well, okay, there's nothing there that we can tap into. Once we have determined that they would recognize the person again, what I do is I give them, we go through a series of just interview talking about what happened. And then I say, go through these series of photographs and see if you can find people that kind of look like the guy. And what I'm going there is visual to visual, what they saw rather than how they can describe it. Because most people don't have the verbal skills to describe to the level that I need to draw it. But they can pick out pictures and say, well, it kind of looked like this guy, except, and then they'll give me the changes. So I know exactly what they're talking about, and we don't have to figure out what a weird-looking guy or funny-looking nose or whatever their terms are. Because those aren't even particularly important.
So I would imagine that when you're doing this, it can be a fairly stressful experience, especially, you know, if emotions are really high, right? For the folks that you're interviewing or you're working with. So how do you kind of manage, you know, their state of being at that time?
But that's part of the interview process. We establish rapport, and we establish that if at any time they can't go on, if there's a problem, we certainly can stop. That's not a problem. The worst that can happen is they can spend some time with us. I mean, there's no negative or downside to it. We take breaks whenever possible. And usually in the first part, the early part of the interview, it's not as stressful as once we start getting closer. If it's an emotional drawing, once we start getting closer to what the person looks like, then they're going to start to, you know, look at it and go, oh, you know, there's that face again that I never want to see. But we handle that in the early part, and we can take breaks. We're prepared for emotional reactions, and we're very, very sympathetic to and empathetic to what they're going through.
You know, I'm curious to know your thoughts on this popularity of true crime now, right? I mean, there are podcasts. I mean, it just goes on. And how obsessed so many people are with true crime. And I will be fully transparent. I'm one of those people, but I must say that, I mean, this goes back to when I was 8 years old. I remember sneaking an Ann Rule book when I was 8 years old and reading it. I mean, I have had a fascination with this, you know, the majority of my life. But what do you think it is? And what's that like in your line of work to just have it become such a part of our culture now?
Well, it's been a part of my life for an awful long time, since I'm obviously older than you, if you remember reading Ann Rule at 8. Oh, my. my dad was with law enforcement starting when I was very, very young, and eventually started the North Idaho Regional Crime Lab and the North Idaho School of Law Enforcement. So from the time I was in my teens, I was actually working on these cases on something that they didn't know before. They called it that weird thing, forensics, and nobody had even heard the term before. So I started working on that just because my background was as an artist. And my dad would come home and say, oh, take a look at this. This is supposed to be blood spatter. What does it look like to you? You know, and So from the time I was very young, this was just a part of my life. And I do think people are fascinated. I think it's because, in part, it's part of our nature to want to learn what has happened to other people so maybe it won't happen to us. Mm-hmm. Or we might know someone that they've gone through this. Nobody wants to go through it, but we are riveted because we need to learn, okay, this is a dangerous thing. This is a bad thing. How can we prevent it? How can we stay away? And we do that by watching this on television. It's also the whole idea of a mystery, okay? Mm-hmm. What really happened? And the mystery part of it just fascinates us.
So I want to talk a little bit about some of the other work that you do, because as I mentioned in the intro, you actually also can reconstruct skulls of missing homicide victims. And I know that could be triggering for some folks, and so apologize for the language there, but we do need to talk about this because a lot can be discovered by what you're able to do. So can you talk to us about how that works and how you're able to you know, help maybe identify some of these victims?
Oh, absolutely. So it usually starts by a hunter or a hiker finding a skull in the woods, and the first thing they do is they send it to a forensic anthropologist and determine male, female, and whatever they can from the skull. And then they look for, okay, who's missing? Because that's the first place you want to start. But what we don't have is a uniform database of, say, dental records or DNA. Now, that's changing. I can come back to that. But basically, the DNA is your definitive identification. But what if it's older? What if there is no DNA? What if the DNA is degraded? Where do we start? And the reconstruction is a way in which we can quickly, because DNA does take a little bit of time, we can quickly put a face on this and just see if it triggers anyone saying, oh, you know what, that looks like that guy we saw, you know, 5 years ago, or that looks like mm-hmm. my classmate, or whatever it is that triggers it. All we need is a place to start. And so the drawing is a place to start. It's like, oh, that kind of reminds me of, and then we can go from there. So it just might speed up the process slightly. Then they can go ahead and look at x-rays or DNA or dental records or other identifying features. So it's much like the drawings. It's just a starting point to help to speed up the process and aid in identification.
So you also do courtroom sketches, like for crime scenes, for the courtroom. So why are those renderings so important?
So there's two different things when we talk about courtroom. One is to prepare the trial charts called demonstrative evidence, and that was actually where I started in my career, is working with the crime lab. They would take all this physical evidence and needed it prepared so a jury could understand what happened visually by stepping it out or mounting it or what have you. So that's necessary for people to understand when you're talking about, say, an accident reconstruction or anything like that. Mm-hmm. They need to see exactly how it went down because words may not be able to do it. The other mm-hmm. part of courtroom is going into the courtroom and actually drawing where the judge has said, no, we're not going to allow cameras. Then mm-hmm. I can also go into the courtroom, usually working for a television station, and do the sketches that they show on the 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock news showing people testifying. That is the single hardest form of forensic art, I have to say, because they won't hold
still.
They keep moving around.
Yeah, you want to be like, can you stop moving for a minute? I'm trying to work here.
I know, I really want to jump up and say, okay, hold that pose, okay? Not much longer. Hold it just a little bit more. Keep that finger pointed, you know, or whatever. And they don't. They move around, yeah. And it's just highly irritating.
I know. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, I have to tell you, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you. And I could talk to you all day about this. But what a fascinating line of work that you were in. And thank you so much for sharing your insights with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and I appreciate the time, and take care. Have a wonderful day.
You too. We have been talking with forensic artist Carrie Stewart Park. She'll be talking about Using Art to Solve Crime at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. That's at Boise State University. Her talk will be on March 6th. So we will, of course, put more information on our website for you in case you would like to go and learn more about that. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.